This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Edie Falco, stars in the Showtime series Nurse Jackie, playing an ER nurse who's addicted to pills.
Hi, my name is Jackie, and I am an addict. And today I'm sober for 1 year.
Well, not exactly sober, as we found out at the end of last season. Nurse Jackie's sixth season starts Sunday and finds Jackie once again taking drugs and hiding her addiction. Edie Falco gave one of the great performances in TV history as Carmela Soprano on The Sopranos. We're going to hear about both of those roles, as well as her own experiences with sobriety, breast cancer, and parenthood. Her characters have also had tough times with their teenage children. Terry spoke with Falco last Wednesday and began with a scene from the season 6 premiere of Nurse Jackie. Although Jackie is back on drugs, she's still going to her 12-step meetings, pretending to be sober. In this scene, she's at a restaurant with one of the women from the meeting, who likes to speak her mind, even if it means being rude to another member of the group. Here's Edie Falco and Julie White.
I know it's supposed to help, but I hate the program.
Me too. It's all of that 12-step God talk. It just drives me up a tree. Which is why I kind of pick and choose. A little of the big book, some therapy, dash of Oprah. I mean, it's taken me a long time and a few slips to find my path. How about you?
Well, the day of my 1 year anniversary, they got me a nice cake. I took a pill.
Ooh! My first relapse, I went on a 3-month bender. It was so much work. All the lying and hiding.
Trying to catch the next high.
Oh, explaining to my husband where the money went.
Trying to cover the high instead of just relaxing into it.
That was the worst.
You want to tell these people, just get away from me so I can enjoy this.
I took a lot of bubble baths with a bottle of whiskey.
Sounds nice.
It was so nice, which is why that was just my first relapse. Keep going to meetings. Work the steps. You got a sponsor.
I'm not very good with authority.
Okay, I am very good with people who are not good with authority.
Okay.
That's a scene from the new season of Nurse Jackie. Edie Falco, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you back on the show.
A pleasure to be here.
So I'm kind of sorry that Jackie is back on drugs. It's like a nice plot twist, but I hate to see that happen to her. How do you feel about her relapse?
Not unlike the way I feel about anybody's relapse, even though she's pretend. It does, I think, pretty accurately mirror the experience in real life of when someone that you know is not able to stay on board. It's heartbreaking and makes you feel helpless and all that stuff. So I think it's pretty accurate.
But isn't there the actress part of you thinking, great, more plot twists?
Not really.
No?
I don't know. I mean, there are, from my vantage point, far more plot twists in an individual trying to stay clean. It's way harder. So, whatever. I'm not the writer, and I'm thrilled to do whatever they put in front of me. But it's funny. The actress part of me is also somehow connected to the human part of me. And I don't know, you kind of want to put out there that it's possible to free oneself from this. But I'm not the writer, as I said, so I'm happy to do whatever is put in front of me.
Do you feel like you understand why she would have chosen the first anniversary of her sobriety to start using again?
Absolutely. The mind of an addict is so seemingly irrational to an outsider, but there are all kinds of things at play that are not easily understood. But, she's about to hit a huge milestone, and if the interior work isn't done, like the why she uses drugs in the first place, it's kind of hard to just be okay with the way it looks on the outside. So from my vantage point, she was not making her priority to remain sober, and so it will slip away.
Your role in Nurse Jackie connects with two major things that have happened in your life. You had breast cancer. I'm sure you spent a lot of time in hospitals. Mm-hmm. And also you had an alcohol problem, so you understand the difficulties of sobriety. So just playing somebody, Nurse Jackie, who's always struggling not to use and has just succumbed and is taking pills again, does that amplify your own difficulties as somebody, you know, who is sober and has to work to stay that way?
No, it makes me more firmly grounded. I don't know that everybody has this reaction, but it's been a very rough year. I've lost a lot of friends this year to various things, but a number of them have been drug and alcohol related. And, like, I'm not an old person, and these people are my age and younger. And each time this happened, you know, there are no words for the waves of gratitude that came over me, that I am clear that for the moment, you know, as they say in a day at a time, but I'm safe. And no, it does not shake me. For some reason, it makes me stronger. I think I'm also in a place where I can take most things and translate it into something that makes me stronger, which is a testament to the fact that I've put a lot of work into this stuff.
Jackie and Carmela from The Sopranos had similar problems, teenage kids who are rebelling, talking back to you,
mm-hmm.
which I suppose is pretty typical.
Well, yeah. I was going to say Jackie, Carmela, and every mother I've ever heard of. Yeah.
Right. And you've both tried, you know, both characters have tried tough love in ways that aren't necessarily very effective.
Right.
So you have two children, age 9 and 6. Are you dreading their teenage years based on the series that you've starred in?
You know, you can live in denial for a few more years in my case that somehow it'll be different for me. So I'm kind of hanging on for dear life to that at the moment. If present behavior is any indication, I'm in for a wallop.
That's not what I thought you were going to say.
So sorry. No, yeah, I have two very bright, very willful kids, and with me as a mom. So there's a lot of energy and headstrong individualism in my household.
Can you imagine saying any of the things that Jackie or Carmela have said to their teenagers?
I would like to say no. But the things that go on in parenting, I've been shocked by my own reactions to things, my children's reactions to my reactions. They kind of are otherworldly. There is very little that brings out more deep-seated stuff than the parent-child relationship I've found. You don't even know what's going to come out of your mouth when you feel as helpless as you sometimes do in the face of a smart kid.
What's an example of something that you've said that's really surprised you?
Oh, gosh. This is going to be terrible. But I'll tell you, my son was issue with coming into my bed. This is some years ago now. And he kept coming in my bed in the middle of the night when I'm half asleep. I was working at the time, so I was getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And he came into my bed. And I think the words were, "If you don't get out of my bed, I will throw you down the stairs." My son looked at me wide-eyed and went back into bed. And then in the morning, he said, "Did you say last night that you were going to throw me down the stairs?" And I was like blushing. I said, "Anderson, I said that to you. And I cannot believe I said it." Has become now something we joke about. And every once in a while, he's like, "What, are you going to throw me down the stairs?" I'm like, "Anderson, I am sorry. I'm not responsible for what I say at 3 a.m. when I'm not getting sleep." So anyway, yes, it's really insane what happens under dire circumstances, lack of sleep and you know, kids who want their way. So anyway, I'm not proud of that, and I'm, you know, deeply working on it, let's just say.
Your parents divorced when you were 14. Were there big fights in your family?
There were, I guess. It's funny how it's like a big blur, a lot of what happened when I was younger, and it's funny, I didn't even know that I was 14 when that happened. So, but
well, I read that. I can't guarantee you that that was accurate, but that's what I read.
I think I might have been younger, and then they also remarried each other, so I'm not quite sure when these things happened. Yeah, and then they split up and got back together any number of times, but without the paperwork, so it's a little complicated as to what happened when. But yeah, there were fights.
Did you mouth off to them like the teenagers?
You know, I didn't. Uh-huh. If asked this question, they may think otherwise, but I don't think I did. I was a really compliant sort of kid. I was a bit of a goody two-shoes, which annoyed my siblings no end. I was the one who would tattle if I smelled pot smoke coming from the other end. It's like, "Mom, I don't want to say anything, but, Yeah. But I did. And so, yeah.
That's a long,
got a reputation.
There's a long distance between the Goody Two-Shoes and the characters that you're most famous for, Nurse Jackie and Carmela.
Well, it's because I didn't go through it then. So I get to live it out now. It's one of the beauties of the thing I do for a living.
Does it feel good?
It feels tremendously good, yeah. To act out in anger and to feel righteous about it and to not have there be any real ramifications is exquisite. Yes, I recommend it to anyone who might be interested.
The ramifications are all good. I mean, for you, it's great acting performances.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they yell cut and I can give a big hug and kiss to whatever child I'm acting opposite, which I always do because
really?
It's mortifying.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'll say, you know, I'm not really mean.
Yeah. So did you what's the name of the actor who played Anthony Jr.?
Oh, Robert Eiler.
Robert Eiler, yeah. You had these incredible fights with him because he was the child left at home when Meadow, your daughter, was already on her own and in college.
Right.
And he was just so lost, you know, just so very lost. And he would have these, like, terrible fights with you. Would you give him a big hug afterwards?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I just adore that boy so much. It's weird. You bring him up and he comes to my mind and it feels like a long involved dream that I had, you know, where he was my son. And it's such a crazy thing that I do for a living because they are all dreams, sometimes as real as my real life, with an emotional content almost as dimensional, you know. But yes, I loved him very much and he was such a sweet kid. And so, yes, I was constantly apologizing for the work I had to do.
I feel like The Sopranos, although it ended years ago, is still so fresh for me because even though I watched it the first time around, I had been watching reruns of it over the past couple of months because it played on HBO Signature, which is one of the HBO channels. But anyways, the series just ended, you know, like a couple of weeks ago. You were telling me before there's episodes you have never seen.
Yeah. Well, we made a lot of them. We made, I don't know the number, but pretty close to 100. And also watching them is a different experience, of course, for me than for someone who isn't involved in it. There's a lot of judgment, like, oh, that didn't work, or that oh, I hate the way that outfit looks, or what, you know what I mean? And so sometimes I would avoid the experience altogether. So I will eventually. I keep thinking I'll be ready sooner than I am to sit down and watch the series in its entirety. I would love to.
You know what I was wondering? One of the defining traits of Carmela, Tony Soprano's wife, is that she's in such denial. I mean, she knows what she wants to know when she needs to know it, and when she doesn't need to know it and wants to deny it, she doesn't know it. So she really knows that Tony is, you know, the head of the mob in his part of Jersey.
Right.
But she doesn't know the specific details of, like, who he's beaten up or who he's ordered killed or who he's extorting. But, you know, she gets the gist of it. But, you know, she acts very innocent about it unless she wants to intimidate somebody. And in that case, like, her husband's Tony Soprano. Do you know who he is?
Right.
But anyways, I was wondering if you almost protected yourself from watching some episodes so that you wouldn't know, what Carmela wouldn't know about the actual acts of brutality that Tony was responsible for, or, you know, the person himself who was doing the killing or the
I'd never thought of that. That's actually highly possible. I was aware more about I didn't want to see him with other women.
Really?
That was the part that I found harder to, that Edie found harder to see. There was no way I couldn't let it get into my system in a way that would bother me. It gets very complicated, this stuff, you know, this whole acting stuff. And not just, it's not just a play or a movie. This went on for 10 years. So there is this alter ego thing about what actually goes on that the character slash me that I don't know about. So, yeah, I think on some level, to protect myself from the other women, I didn't watch it so much. But I had less of a hard time about the people he was killing, which I'm sure is more for me and my shrink to talk about. But we'll get to that.
I think Carmela might have been that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you couldn't,
that's right.
You couldn't watch any of it because Tony was with a woman on just about every episode.
Hey, I still haven't watched them, so don't tell me.
Well, you're in for some heartbreak.
You know, whatever. 10 years later, I'm still in denial.
Well, your characters used to fight a lot, and I thought I'd play an example of one of the fights. And this is a session, your first session with Tony's therapist, Dr. Melfi, who's played by Lorraine Bracco. And you're there with Tony to, you know, talk about his anxiety attacks. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it ends up in a big fight. So, here's the scene.
Anthony's attacks, how do they make you feel? Well, concerned, of course. Helpless. A little frustrated, maybe.
With your inability to help him?
To tell the truth, I was referring to your inability to help him.
She has helped me. What are you talking about?
You've been coming here for 3 years, Tony. You still pass out on a regular basis.
I understand your frustration. Did Anthony share with you any of our insights about his last panic attack?
I told you, remember? The gabagool and my mother when I was a little kid.
Right, yes.
Do you think that there's anything in the present family dynamic that could serve as a trigger? Something in your dialoguing, perhaps?
Excuse me?
I don't really know you that well. We're trying to get to root causes.
Like maybe you do things, you know, that have some effect on me?
Oh, really?
What? People affect each other in life.
Oh, I get it. Is this how it works? You can't get any answers out of him, so you start looking for someone else to point the finger at?
She's not saying anything. Why are you getting so defensive?
You know what, Tony? Maybe you should explore your own behavior. Maybe you pass out because you're guilty over something. Maybe the fact that you stick your into anything with a pulse. You ever thought of exploring that as a root cause?
Very nice. That's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I told you months ago I broke it off with that Russian person, right?
It's incredible. It's like people who smoke their whole lives and then they sue the cigarette companies when they get cancer.
You know, you agreed to come here. Ah, forget it. This is ridiculous.
Right, just sit there. Silence. Anger. And then you pass out and you blame the rest of the world.
Yeah, I love you too.
It's a scene from The Sopranos with my guest Edie Falco and with James Gandolfini and Lorraine Bracco. What was it like for you to listen to that?
Oh my gosh, so bizarre. It's like another life, another lifetime ago. I had a million thoughts. I forgot how good the writing is and how funny it is and how much dimension each of the characters have. And, you know, the sound of each voice is so familiar and so kind of not forgotten, but certainly far away.
You were saying earlier, though, when you would have a fight, a fight in character with one of your children on The Sopranos, when the scene was over, you'd give them a big hug just so that they knew the difference between your real feelings about them and Carmela's anger at their character. So when you would have a big fight with Tony, which you would do frequently, would you and James Gandolfini express your genuine appreciation and respect for each other afterwards?
No.
Not necessarily because we're adults?
We're adults. Yeah, we're adults. And also, I've said before also that Jim and I, we didn't know each other all that well, really. We didn't socialize much. And it was not on purpose, I don't think, or at least not consciously so. But I think because of that, or maybe because I wanted that to be the case, is he really existed only as Tony to me. So, because there wasn't really a lot of information about Jim, the guy who showed up to play Tony. So, you know, it a lot of it felt pretty real. And just to sort of jump back to our real people at the end of a scene would have felt less satisfying for me. You know, we pretty much were husband and wife when we were on that set, and it made an exquisitely satisfying acting experience for sure.
Were you particularly sad when he died that you never got to know him as a man?
You know, that's a complicated question. Gosh. I don't know. I mean, I love Jim very much, but we both had very, very full lives on different sides of the country. And the nature of this business that I'm in is so bizarre that you can have that kind of close, however pretend, relationship with an actor and then not really have them in your life much at all afterwards. I think it's more the rule than not that, you know, you move on to another project and those people become your family. It's sort of definitely an odd career choice for someone who, you know, like anybody who wants connection.
You had a lot on your plate during the making of The Sopranos. During The Sopranos, you were diagnosed with breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've read, like the day you were diagnosed, you went to the set and shot a scene.
Yeah. I found out in the morning, and then I had to go to work. And I told very few people, but I told the producer, one of the producers, and I said, I have an opportunity to meet this doctor in an hour. Can I go and do that and then come back and shoot? And that's what I did. I met this one doctor who talked me through the next step or whatever. And then I went and shot a couple of scenes after that. And that was pretty surreal. You know, I don't remember a whole lot of that day, except that I was not there much at all. And it was okay, because I think there were scenes where he and I were something about walking in a parking lot with a bag of groceries, and I had to drop the groceries or something. It's funny. I have very weird memories of that day. But, yeah. But it helped me to just keep moving, to not have it be this huge, you know, comma in my life where everything waited. I was able to pretty much keep up my schedule and go through what I needed to go through. I wouldn't have done well if everybody had known and been. It's so funny. I watch people who are diagnosed now and how differently they deal with it than I did. I also know, I think I would deal with it differently today than I did back then. Hopefully I won't have to. But, you know, you are who you are at that time. And I needed to keep it very private, and that helped me get through it.
So was the producer the only person who knew on the set?
Producer, and I think she told David Chase at some point, and that was it.
Oh, so nobody knew the whole time?
No, it was that was very important to me. I had my own hair for the whole show. All these big crazy blonde get-ups were actually my own hair until I lost my hair and they made a wig. But nobody noticed the difference. It all looked exactly the same. And
so the makeup people probably knew, right?
Yes, that's right. My hair and makeup people knew. Is that right? That's right.
And they kept your secret.
That's right. And they started doing my hair and makeup a little more privately, because normally we all sit in there and we chat and stuff. But when I had to go put my hair on, you know, they would bring me to another room. Until then, I'd been wearing a hat or something. Also, it was towards the end of the season, so we're doing crazy hours, and everybody was exhausted. People were wiped out. So the truth is, I looked better than anybody on the set. So nobody noticed that anything was going on with me. You know, we were all going through it at the time.
So let me ask you, like, one of the side effects of chemo, a common side effect is mouth sores. And you didn't have that?
No, I didn't have that.
Good.
I've talked to a number of women who have been diagnosed since me, just to kind of talk them through what my experience was. And I think because I'm made up of strong stuff, and I also, by that point, I was already taking care of myself very well. So I fared tremendously well during the chemo. Actually, it sounds psychotic, but I kind of loved the day or two after chemo, because you get a steroid. And I was a runner at the time. And I kept running through the whole thing as my hair was falling out. But I could run my butt off. Like, the day after chemo, I was running, like, 5 miles in like, 40 minutes or some crazy thing. I remember thinking, this is great. So anyway, the one thing I remember is that smells were really rough, because I would run along the West Side Highway and suddenly the smells of gasoline and just the city smells were way harder to take when I was on chemo, for whatever reason.
Well, Edie Falco, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
Edie Falco spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Falco stars in the Showtime series Nurse Jackie, which is beginning its 6th season. Matthew Weiner's Mad Men begins its 7th season Sunday on AMC. Every season, as this outstanding period drama has made its way through the 1960s, Weiner has been increasingly insistent about the things he doesn't want critics to reveal in advance. This year, that confidentiality wish list is almost laughably long, and includes not only the year in which the story resumes, but specifics about certain relationships, both professional and personal. But there's something to say here while still honoring the spirit of Weiner's request. This is the final season of Mad Men, and AMC is spreading it out over 2 7-episode chunks, one now, the other in 2015. So one way or another, we are looking at the final chapters of Mad Men. And what the season opener does is set the stage for a lengthy, long-awaited climax. When we last saw John Hamm as Madison Avenue advertising genius Don Draper, Draper had stripped off the facade he had worn as protection throughout the series. He confessed to his true past as a boy raised in a whorehouse, not only to his children, but to his colleagues at work during a pitch to an advertising client. Immediately, he lost his chance to move to the West Coast office his firm was opening, and there were bound to be other consequences. This final season, it appears, will be all about those consequences. Don always has been resourceful and resilient, and those traits are in full display in the season 7 opener. His confession last season has altered him. In his behavior as well as his demeanor, he's a noticeably changed man. You can tell that even from one of the few scenes from Mad Men that reveals no secrets about where the series is going. Just that Don is going somewhere on a plane. Earlier in the show, we had a tracking shot of him at the airport, standing still but being propelled by a moving sidewalk, just like Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate. A film image so iconic, it must be an intentional echo. And on the return trip, Don boards the plane in what is now a laughably glamorous depiction of air travel. Overhead luggage racks are all but empty, just like many of the seats. Alcoholic drinks are free and plentiful. The stewardesses are helpful and beautiful. And so is the passenger Don finds seated next to him. She's played by Neve Campbell from Party of Five, and she's as sexy as everything else on the plane. But this time, even as she nestles closer to him in the darkness of a red-eye flight, Don the salesman may or may not be buying.
This is nice. I usually sleep alone.
What about the man that gave you that ring?
He passed away. A year ago, actually. I was, He wanted his ashes scattered at Pebble Beach.
How was that?
I failed. It's a very popular spot for such things. Apparently, they don't want another sand trap. I ended up at his second choice, Disneyland.
Really?
Have you ever been there?
I have. Where is he now?
Tom Sawyer Island.
That's probably a popular destination, too.
Yes. They were very vigilant. It took some doing.
How old was he?
He would have been 50.
So much older.
He worked fast, too.
It's a secret, until Sunday's telecast, how much time has elapsed in the lives of the Mad Men characters since the end of the previous episode, which was set around Thanksgiving 1968. But it won't take long for viewers to figure it out. Just listen to the music on the soundtrack, or watch the TVs in the background, or pinpoint the year of the TV pilot for which Don's wife Megan, played by Jessica Paré, is auditioning. Well, maybe only TV critics will hear that show's title and be able to name that year. But for other Mad Men viewers, just seeing what Megan wears and how evocatively she wears it is an even better clue. Because these are, in essence, the closing chapters of a TV novel, don't expect every character to show up in every chapter. A few old favorites are missing in the opener, just as a few new ones are introduced. But this first season 7 episode isn't all just set up. It's well written and beautifully framed, and we see some characters who have evolved considerably already and are on clear paths to change even more along with the times themselves. For others, it's the end of an era, the start of a new age that is destined to leave them behind. From the very start, that is what Mad Men has been all about. And in this final season, we'll finally get to see who survives the transition from those turbulent times and who doesn't. That's all I know for now. But even if I knew more, I don't think I could say. After all, that would be telling. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. If you have young children, you may know by heart the songs from the Disney animated musical Frozen. A lot of kids are playing those songs over and over. One of them, Let It Go, won the Oscar this year for Best Original Song. Our next guests wrote the songs for Frozen. Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez are married and have two children, both of whom sing on the soundtrack. The movie just came out on DVD and Blu-ray. Robert Lopez also co-wrote the satirical Broadway musicals Avenue Q and The Book of Mormon, which is now touring. He is now an EGOT, the acronym for the select few who have won the four major showbiz awards, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. Kristen and Robert spoke with Terry last Thursday. Frozen is about two sisters, a princess Anna and her older sister Elsa, who becomes the young queen. The older sister has a magical power, the ability to turn things and even people into ice. When she was a child, that power got out of control and hurt her younger sister. Ever since, Elsa has isolated herself to prevent her magic from causing harm. After she runs away from her kingdom to protect it from her magic and is completely alone in her ice castle, she feels safe to finally unleash her powers. And she sings Let It Go, the song that won the Oscar. The character is voiced by Idina Menzel.
Don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know.
That's Let It Go from the soundtrack of Frozen, written by my guests Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez. Welcome to both of you. Congratulations on the Oscar, and thank you so much for being here. That song is a real turning point in the movie when the older sister feels safe to unleash her power. Would you tell us the story of writing the song?
We wrote Let It Go knowing that we had this moment where Elsa's powers that she'd been keeping secret came out, and that she was going to be chased out of a village, head up a mountain, and transform into the Snow Queen. At the time, she was mostly
the villain
still
at
this
point. She was blue-skinned, and she had spiky hair. And at the end of the movie, she came down the mountain with an army of evil snowmen to ransack the town, which is very different from the way the movie now ends. But it took a long time to get there. And one of the focal moments of when that started to change was when we wrote Let It Go. And we wrote Let It Go so that she still might be the villain. That line,
Let the storm rage on,
the cold never bothered me anyway, was meant to, if we were going down that villain path, it would fall in line with that lyric. But basically, when this song came to us, we were on a little stroll through Prospect Park in Brooklyn near our house, and we both started to sort of improv what Elsa might be feeling like. So we stood up on picnic tables and
we got very emo. We decided we didn't want this song to be a traditional Disney princess song, so we were listening to singer-songwriters like Amy Mann and Tori Amos and Sarah Bareilles, and actually it was Bobby who kept saying, I feel like if I were a high school student, that this would be that moment that you had worked and you'd studied and you hadn't gone out, and then you just failed a test miserably. And what would that feel like? And he came up with the line. And all the lines that sound like a drag queen are the lines Bobby wrote.
I didn't notice that line sounded like a drag queen.
There's one line, when he sings it, it sounds like a drag queen. The kingdom of isolation, and it looks like I'm the queen. That was Bobby's line. I did more of the feminist, be the good girl you always have to be. I did my lines tend to be more of from a female perspective. And
once we had the idea for the song, it came quite quickly. Took about a day and a half.
Part of me thinks that parents would probably prefer that their children sing hold it in, hold it back, because sometimes you don't want kids to let it go, because they're just going to be they're so crazy as it is. Do you know what I mean? you want them to have a little bit of inhibition.
That's true, but I think at the end of the day, getting the message of don't allow fear or shame to keep you from being the person you should be.
Okay,
I imagine on a global level, that's a good lesson for them to have before teenagerhood.
You kind of said that in fewer words when you accepted the Oscar, because you thanked your two children, and you said something to the effect that you didn't want fear or shame to inhibit them from being like the special people that they are. And I was wondering if you were thinking of yourself when you said that, if you had dealt with fear and shame as a child.
Well, sometimes you write something for a character and you think you're just writing for a character, but when you have to musicalize it or turn it into lyrics, little things from your own gut start to ooze in there. And I think that, I think with Let It Go, Bobby and I had feelings we needed to express. Because I imagine who doesn't have some fear or shame in their life? You know, there's the shame that you get when you're in middle school and you're not the popular girl and you just, all you're thinking is like, please let me not mess up today. And even now as a female writer and a mom and a wife, you just spend so much time, at least I spend so much time trying to be good at all those things, trying to be good at relationships and a good mom and a good citizen of the world, and also try and fit into the jeans and look good on the red carpet. And sometimes you just have to go, you know what? Something's got to slide here. I need some French fries.
Bobby, you've mostly parodied inspirational songs in shows like Avenue Q and The Book of Mormon. And in fact, why don't we play one of the kind of satirical inspirational songs? And this is from The Book of Mormon, and the song is I Believe. And just say a few words about the song before we hear it and what you had in mind.
This song was also brought about by story concerns, really. We were looking at this character from a very unironic place when we figured out that he needed a song in this moment. He was the main character of the story. He had just bailed on his mission. We realized that we needed him to find something to latch onto, to double down on his faith for Mormonism, and then take action. Now, when we went about writing the song, I suggested, oh, let's take a look at that song, I Have Confidence in Me, from the movie of The Sound of Music. And I guess as a result, we kind of got into the spirit of his actual inspirational spirit as we wrote it. But it's really more from a point of view of mocking his inspiration at the same time as feeling it.
So here's a kind of satirical inspirational ballad from The Book of Mormon, sung by the great Andrew Rannells.
Ever since I was a child, I tried to be the best. So what happened? My family and friends all said I was blessed. So what happened? It was supposed to be all so exciting, to be teaching of Christ across the sea. But I allowed my faith to be shaken. Oh, what's the matter with me? I've always longed to help the needy, to do the things I never dared. This was the time for me to step up. So then why was I so scared? A warlord who shoots people in the face. What's so scary about that? I must trust that my Lord is mightier and always has my back. Now I must be completely devout. I can't have even one shred of doubt. I believe that the Lord God created the universe. I believe that he sent his only son to die for my sins. And I believe that ancient Jews built boats and sailed to America. I am a Mormon, and a Mormon just believes.
That's a song from The Book of Mormon, which was co-written by my guest, Robert Lopez, who also co-wrote with Kristen Anderson Lopez all the songs from the Disney animated musical Frozen. The DVD just came out. They are also married and have two children. So did you think back to inspirational songs from your childhood and which ones worked and which ones didn't?
You know, we didn't for this song, but for the first time in forever, we did. For the first time in forever, we were very clearly calling on that that princess tradition of the girl pulls up a little stool and tells the audience what is in her heart. Of the, you know, look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think? Like, we were hoping to get that feeling.
Yeah, we didn't think of this as an inspirational song flat out. We thought of it as half inspiration and half a little bit charismatic, like, I don't need any of you kind of song.
We did write a version for Let It Go that was very Avril Lavigne, sort of like, I don't like your girlfriend. I think you need a new one. We had sort of that kind of version when she really was a villain.
Right. No, but this one, that line, the cold never bothered me anyway,
was a holdover from that. And we still do it with the Avril Lavigne move.
And we insisted that Elsa slam the doors of the palace into the right in our faces at the end of the song, that there be that element of, oh, this character doesn't need us anymore.
So, you know, Frozen, there's like two princesses in it. One of them becomes the queen. And I know, like a lot of mothers and probably fathers too, are kind of disturbed when their children get into princess fantasies, because it can be a very retro way of being female. You know, everything's about being beautiful and being, you know, kissed and saved by the handsome prince and everything. So, Kristen, here you are. Writing a princess musical, were there certain things that you knew you had to avoid?
Absolutely. In fact, if you have the deluxe CD, you will see my very strong strike across the bow at all princess myth things in the form of a song called We Know Better, which was a song that was cut, but it basically was these two princesses bonding over all of the things that the world expects and thinks of them. You know, they think that they're perfect and sweet and sugar and spice and all things nice. And it was the two of them misbehaving and being fully well-rounded children with all the good and bad and imagination and mischief that I really feel it's important for our girls to be allowed to be. So, and it got cut, but you can tell the whole movie is full of this point of view as much as Jennifer Lee and I could put in it, because we're both Park Slope moms, and I knew I wouldn't be able to push my kids on the swing at the playground if I had written a movie where the girl wore the puffy dress and was saved not by anything active she did, but by being beautiful enough to be kissed by a prince.
You have two daughters. Did they go through a princess phase?
Oh my gosh, Terry, we have a rack. We literally have a costume rack with maybe 50 princess dresses. But our princesses, you know, they shoot arrows and they do math. And I was always like, we can be like Snow White, the doctor to the African orphans.
Well, that's funny, you know, because obviously you don't want your daughters to adopt the traditional princess stories too deeply, but here you are writing all these songs about princesses, and you cast your children in the movie, and one of them plays one of the princesses when she's a young child, when she does the voice. So are you sending your daughters mixed messages?
I hope not. I mean, who doesn't send their daughters mixed messages in this world? You do your best not to send them mixed messages, but every time you look in the mirror and say, oh, I got to put on Spanx under this dress, you're sending a mixed message. That said, I think that there are things about the princess tradition that we can celebrate in terms of a female being the main character of a story, which is in itself very subversive in this day and age in Hollywood. This time we had two females as a main character in the story. And in this case, we were talking about their relationship. At its heart, we were talking about the relationship between two females, which only 1% of all stories in Hollywood actually pass that test.
Yeah, so were the Disney people worried, like, what about the boys? What's in it for the boys?
We wanted to make sure that the boys in the audience knew that there was something in it for them from the very beginning of the movie. We didn't want to hit them over the head with princess girl musical, which led to the way we ended up opening the film, which is almost an homage to the roustabout sequence in Dumbo with the railway workers. And what we're trying to communicate to the audience is, A, what the story is about, but on the other hand, you know, there's going to be singing, there's going to be adventure.
So how did you both meet?
The BMI workshop.
Yeah, we were both classmates in the BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop, which is a class for budding young songwriters for musical theater.
And what happened first? Like dating each other or collaborating with each other?
Dating. We were dating a while. And actually, the night we met was the first night he presented in a little cabaret smoker setting his first song from Avenue Q. It was three songs, two of which were cut, right?
Yeah.
And he was wearing a red yarn wig, so of course that's the man of your dreams, writing a puppet musical, living with his parents. but, you know, something in me knew he was the real deal and that we just both needed to grow up a little bit. And we were dating for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and he needed some help on a song for another Disney property, Bear in the Big Blue House, and invited me over to his house to come collaborate. And I took the bus from Astoria, where I lived at the time, to Greenpoint, where he lived, and I wrote a whole lyric on the bus, and I showed up at his door, and he promptly said, "We're not doing this."
No, we're not doing her lyric.
We're not doing that. We're
going to collaborate together.
And that's how it's gone ever since.
It's been a little awkward ever since. No, we, you know, we've evolved this process over the years that is very easy. And we, you know, we have a lot of communication skills from being married and working through our problems that come in real handy when you're writing a song and you hit problems. You're always going to hit problems. You're always going to hit, you know, those little relationship human problems of like, oh, are you just hungry or do you really hate what I just said?
Or this mood you're in right now, this is about your mother. It's not about the song.
She means herself, her own mother.
Thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been great fun, and congratulations on all the success you've been having.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. I'm going to do my best not to send my daughter mixed messages for the rest of the day.
We've learned our lesson.
Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez wrote the songs for the Disney animated film Frozen, which is now out on DVD. They spoke with Terry last Thursday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancourt.